But so we can do the hearing. Yes, Ms.
Blackwood. Sorry. Do I need to unmute this speaker and microphone doing?
It would help if it was close to so that we can hear you and it can be recorded.
Okay. Does that work there?
Yes, yeah. That's good. Thank you.
Well, hello again. Nice to be up here. I was whizzing through the gorge looking at those big black clouds thinking, ooh. So I've come up from Dunedin.
It's a bit more exciting on a Sunday afternoon.
Oh, is it? Yes, well, I came through the paperwork and there's quite a lot of snow. Yeah. And you might have heard the news, but the budget has announced some money for wild retreats, which is very exciting. Not enough, but at least it's a good start. So I won't start with the introduction because I think I've been through that before.
Yes.
Just a quick overview of our submission, and then I'm just going to concentrate on the areas where we think there's still some discussion to be had.
Okay.
So Forest and Bird largely supported the definitions that was for Indigenous vegetation and vegetation clearance. And we're very pleased to see that the planner, when I say the planner, I mean the writer of the Section 42 Act report, Craig Barr, has recommended retaining the proposal to include the deliberate application of water as a form of clearance. Because we consider that regarding the application of water as a normal farm activity is not helpful as it is, in effect, the clearance that is important by whatever means. Now, Forest and Bird generally supported the listing of sites identified as significant natural areas and sought the inclusion of scientifically based criteria for the ongoing assessment of Indigenous vegetation for significance and potential additional SNAs to be applied at the time of resource consent. And this is always the nub of SNAs because you have your SNAs that are mapped and identified, but they're not going to be all-encompassing for a number of reasons. So there still needs to be a process through which you can identify additional SNAs that haven't already been identified. And then with regard to the identified SNAs, Forest and Birds sought non-compliance status for the clearance of any Indigenous vegetation in any SNA, and we allowed for exceptions for the maintenance of farm tracks. We didn't like drains, because drains, in our experience, quite often get widened and they have more damage on wetlands, so we excluded drains. For non-significant Indigenous vegetation and habitat, Forest and Birds sought discretionary status for clearance beyond the 500 metres square for Indigenous vegetation generally, or 1,000 metres square for tall tussock grassland. And in recognition of the fact that it's unlikely, as I've mentioned, that all sites meeting criteria for SNAs will be scheduled, we sought discretionary status for any clearance of specific types of vegetation which we considered, from advice from landcare scientists, that would be likely to be assessed as significant. We had a bob each way, because we also supported the Department of Conservation's request for no permitted clearance of sites that meet the SNA criteria. We prefer the department's position, because we think it's more straightforward, and it really means that for pretty much most clearances of vegetation, somebody's going to need to do a site assessment to work out whether it's got threatened species and whether it's something that would meet the criteria. And we stick with that because people talk about balance, but for cake, most of the cake's already been eaten, and so we're really talking about the Indigenous vegetation that remains as the crumbs of what was once a much larger cake. So we think it's justified to be able to have quite a stringent law for Indigenous vegetation. And with regard to the avoidance of adverse effects and biodiversity offsets, we supported the preference for avoidance of adverse effects and the use of biodiversity offsets and no net loss in relation to the residual adverse effects of any unavoidable Indigenous vegetation clearance. And that would be after the mitigation hierarchy. So that's only after there's been the appropriate avoidance, minimisation, remediation and mitigation measures. And we agree that the proposals for the rules and for exotic pines, which come later, the proposals which are applied throughout the district are more certain and relevant to achieving the target RPS and the RMA than the current plan. So we think that the council and staff have made pretty huge steps forward in terms of Indigenous vegetation from what's in the current plan. Last time round we were fighting to even have a rule, so we've made, council's made a lot of progress and we appreciate that. Now just to look at specific policies, I won't read them out because I probably didn't have. So as proposed, this particular policy only provides for this identification of significant natural areas. It doesn't identify what policy approach is with regards to the purpose of identifying them. And if the hearing commissioners consider it's not appropriate to include such a direction within this policy, then we would suggest that another policy is added which specifically sets out what council's approach is to SNAs that haven't been identified. I note that the planner has suggested a change to the policy for priority, changing resource consent process to development proposals. And Forestry Bird opposes that change because it's now unclear how council will require a development proposal to identify SNAs other than through resource consents. So we were happy with it as it was. And it's quite common for areas meeting SNA criteria to be identified through the resource consent process. Now, in terms of protection of SNAs, I agree that it should be wider than consent processes so that protection is captured by conditions on permitted activities. The identification and protection of SNAs is necessary to give effect, of course, to the Act. Looking at policy 33.2.13, the planner has not accepted amendments sought in Forest and Bird submission or the Department of Conservation submission which Forest and Bird supported. Forest and Bird asked the panel to consider amending the policy as sought by DOC, that biodiversity which meets the criteria in the policy, that's the criteria for significance which is now in policy 33.2.1.10, should be excluded from standards that permit removal of Indigenous vegetation. And so the wording there for that suggested policy is to provide standards in the district plan for Indigenous vegetation that is not identified as a significant natural area or threatened species or captured under criteria in policy 33.2.1, but that would be 10 for planner's recommendations. Which are practical to apply and that permit the removal of a limited area of Indigenous vegetation. For consistency in terminology, the term clearance rather than removal should be used. That's the term of the definition. This is another policy that has been rejected from Forest and Bird's submission. However, there is an amended version that has been made, and the wording proposed in the amended chapter. And our view doesn't give effect to Forest and Bird's submission. So our submission sought that anticipated activities must be undertaken in a way that protects the significant Indigenous vegetation habitats of Indigenous fauna and maintains and enhances Indigenous biodiversity. The wording suggested by the planner changes the scope of the policy by limiting the consideration of effects to only effects of clearance. The amendment also removes consideration of efficient use, which councils must have particularly valid to under section 7b of RMA. The term biodiversity values is used many times in this chapter and it's not defined in the RMA, and so we just sought clarity by suggesting that we could drop the word values and just use the term Indigenous biodiversity. And in relation to the next policy, Forest and Bird agrees with the planner's recommendations to delete reference to compensation and the addition of the concept of no net loss. However, we prefer the recommendations for policy, for the policy that were put forward in the statement of evidence by Dr. Lawrence Baillia for the Department of Conservation. The suggested more detailed policy and inclusion of biodiversity offset guidelines in the schedule provides greater clarity. And we observed that Environment Canterbury has included criteria to apply to the use of biodiversity offsets in their RPS. And we're hoping that Otago will be the same, that they've finished their RPS. Forestry supports the addition of the policy with regard to wildlife habitats and lakes and wetlands. And we also endorse the planner's recommendation to accept the pattern as part of the criteria for significance and also the new criteria to see. Forestry Birds sought a new policy to assist in the implementation of Objective 33.2.1 in relation to the enhancement of Indigenous biodiversity. And although there are policies that refer to enhancement, there are no policies that provide much guidance on the enhancement, and specifically to use Indigenous species that naturally occur or previously occurred in the area. And so we suggested facilitate and support restoration of degraded natural ecosystems and Indigenous habitats using Indigenous species that naturally occur and or previously occur in the area. And we note that the strike-throughs in my submission collection, I hope, it was a mistake. So apologies for that. Looking at policy 33.2.1, we support the planner's recommendation to accept the submission, and that's necessary to ensure that potential SNAs are captured. The current schedule of SNAs is bound to be incomplete, as it relied heavily on a desktop survey, which in itself contained incomplete surveys. And even if intensive surveys are undertaken, areas are missed due to landowner concerns or overlooked. As well, over a decade, conservation understanding and knowledge changes. Some species that are not listed as threatened now may become threatened. For example, grey shrublands were not considered as important in the past as they are today. Shrub species once thought to be common are now at risk. And a good example there of Valeria linneata. Sites that are assessed to meet the criteria used to identify SNAs but not scheduled should be treated in the same manner as sites that have been identified and scheduled. And I'll give you the quotes from the Environment Court in the West Coast RPS Sharon case. I'm not sure if I need to read those out or take them as read or give you time to read them. Allowing some clearance of SNAs is in exceptional circumstances, and in allowing that, we would expect that significant adverse effects will need to be avoided. We accept in part the planner's recommendations and consider that the policy would have further certainty if it explicitly states that significant adverse effects have to be avoided. And we've suggested a policy there in our submission, which was to allow the clearance of Indigenous vegetation within SNAs only in exceptional circumstances to ensure that clearance is undertaken in a manner that avoids significant adverse effects and retains the values of the area. And we note the term values is broad, and we've struggled with that better phrase, because unless each SNA has a values description, then this phrase can be subjective. If the plan clearly identifies what those values might be, and how effects on them will be considered, then we think that approach would be acceptable. However, we do prefer the wording set out for us to its original submission. The planner rejected our proposed amendments. Sorry, I'm going through a whole lot of planner reject, but the planner did accept quite a few, so I'm just concentrating on the ones that were all rejected. planner rejected our proposed amendments, which were designed to ensure that any clearance within SNAs would only be permitted for maintenance of existing uses, including roads and structures and their expansion. And we oppose providing for the clearance of new activities. We agree that it's reasonable to allow the continuation of existing uses, but provided there is no increase in intensity. And as argued in our original submission, the construction of fences and even small-scale tracts can have significant effects on biodiversity and may not maintain the balance of the SNA, not only by the clearance of vegetation, but also creating passage for pests and weeds. The exemptions that are set out in section 33.3.4.2 mean that there are no standards provided for the permitted activities. We note that there is no exemption for new tracts, which we endorse. And we assume that that means that new small-scale farm tracts and SNAs will require a consent, as most will be captured by the earthworks restriction in Table 3, which gives guidance to what may constitute a small-scale farm tract. We're not certain that our interpretation is right, but that's how we interpret that law. Looking at the exemptions, Forestry Bird seeks that Tier 2 covenants not be exempt from the rules, and the plan considers it's not necessary as covenants are seen as generally more protective than district plan rules. And in our experience, while that may be true for many covenants, council cannot rely on another party to meet council's requirements under the RMA. And it cannot be guaranteed that there will be restrictions on the clearance of indigenous vegetation that are equivalent to those that are established in the district plan. The Queen Elizabeth II Trust provides for open space covenants, and an open space covenant doesn't refer to the biodiversity. It talks about it being an area of land or body water that serves to preserve or to facilitate the preservation of any landscape of aesthetic, cultural, recreation, scenic, scientific, or social interest or value. And section 20 of that Act sets out the functions of the Act. And again, that doesn't talk about biodiversity, it talks about open space. As far as the bird understands the details of how an area is to be protected by a covenant, they are negotiated with the covenanter and can be given expression through a management plan, neither of which are publicly available. Covenants are not required to be consistent with the policies and objectives of the district plan, and consequently council cannot be suitably meeting its plan or its obligations under the RMA. Now we come to these vexed rules, which we must say, or thank the council's given a pretty good shot at them, and just needs a bit of tinkering. The first major issue that we have is that we sought that any vegetation clearance on the SNA should be non-compliant if it doesn't meet the permitted standards rather than fall into discretionary. And the policies in the proposed plan set out to protect SNAs and avoid activities within SNAs. And policy 33.2.2 only provides for vegetation clearance in SNAs in exceptional circumstances. These policies provide strong backing for a non-compliant status, and non-compliant status gives effect to this policy, whereas discretionary does not. The non-compliant gateway tests mean the activity will either need to meet these policies or the adverse effects of the activity on the environment will be minor. An NC status adds certainty to the policies, the intent of which are to only grant consents in exceptional circumstances or where the adverse effects are less than minor. With regards to Table 2, the proposed rule is a significant improvement upon the existing rule. However, it still allows quite large clearance in areas that are potentially SNAs, and so therefore it does not provide certainty that areas of significant indigenous vegetation will be recognised and protected, with the exception of areas containing threatened species. And just in terms of the use of the word site in the rule, I'm not quite certain how site is to be determined. We assume that it's the definitions in the plan, and those definitions are in relation to lots and certificate of title, which presumably apply to subdivision. And it may be that it's just needed to make sure that those definitions do apply to these rules, or it may be possible to consider the site might be the site of the application area. Frozen Bird is aware that there have been some clarity issues with the use of the term in the Mackenzie District Plan, and so we consider that the plan needs to give better guidance as to the meaning of site. To deal with the problem of identifying and protecting sites that meet the criteria for significance but are not listed in the schedule, Forest and Birds sought that there be no permitted standard for the clearance of Indigenous vegetation occurring within the threatened plant environments. And it is likely that many of the remaining special areas of Indigenous vegetation and habitats will occur in these threatened environments as they are run forest. And as we read the proposed rule, clearance up to 500 metres squared in any site and 50 metres in any site less than 10 hectares may be cleared in threatened environments. And we consider that's too high, and up to 5,000 metres in other circumstances. Russell Bird, as I said before, supported DOC's submission that there be no clearance of an area identified as significant under the criteria in policy 93.2.10. Forest and Birds' preference is to find the best workable mechanism that ensures that areas that meet the criteria for significance are not either deliberately or inadvertently cleared through a permitted activity status. Our submission, and I guess that helps in a sense, because if a farmer goes out, or a developer, or whoever goes out and sees some Indigenous vegetation on their land, most people can at least recognise the difference between Indigenous vegetation and exotic vegetation, it should trigger in their minds that they are potentially going to need to have a role, and we might not have to deal with this situation again. Our submission sought to achieve this by defining specific types of vegetation for which any clearance would require resource consent, and that was based on using advice from Matthew scientist Dr. Susan Walker. And it was based on the Waitaki rule, which we found to be workable. So that was our alternative suggestion, was instead of having provisions for a small amount of clearance, you would just identify the threatened environments and particular kinds of ecosystems that we would expect to find in Queenstown Lakes. And we still think that that is an alternative way, but another way might just be to reduce the size in the rule that you've got already, and to fiddle with it just to make sure that any sites that are potentially going to meet those criteria would need the resource consent. And that's because the provision for the 5,000 square metres is quite large. In terms of definitions, Forest and Bird supported the Department of Conservation's request for a definition of biodiversity offsetting and no net loss. And we consider it's needed in order to provide clarity to the plan and a consistent framework throughout the district. We note that ecologist Mr. Glenn Davis considered that that would be helpful. Forest and Bird supports and endorses the evidence provided by Dr. Lorenz Barrera for the Department of Conservation, which sets out the definitions for biodiversity offsets and no net loss. And we observe that the Canterbury Regional Policy Statement has a definition of no net loss and biodiversity offset. Clearance of Indigenous vegetation, we essentially endorse the recommendations for those, and also the addition of direct drilling, as well as the inclusion of irrigation. Turning to the chapter on wildland trees, essentially we congratulate Council and planners for their comprehensive measures to tackle wildland trees, and we agree with the planners' recommendations for the additional species to be listed as planted. We have observed some pushback from submitters regarding some species, and we urge you to stick with the list and the additions as recommended by the planner. Rowan, although it's beautiful, is a problem, and for example around Makarora, it can be seen establishing under the forest canopy, primarily where there are light gaps and along the margins. Berries made it very attractive to birds, and hence the threat to forests. They're also a threat to open tussock grasslands. In the purpose part of this chapter on wild and exotic trees, we wanted one of the purposes to be to include consideration of the wild and tree impacts on water yield, And that hasn't been accepted by the planner, although they did consider it had merit, and that it would fit with the council's responsibilities for integrated management. I'm reflecting this purpose for relenting Wauru and Tree Street will assist council achieve objective 21.2.3, which refers to safeguarding the life supporting capacity of water through the integrated management of the effects and activities. Council's ecological expert, Mr. Glenn Davis, acknowledges that dense infestations of wildlands will reduce water yield and notes that the invasion of wildlands in riparian zones, valley bottoms and hillside depressions has a disproportionate effect on stream flow. Plan considers that the effects on water yield are more relevant to forestry. We don't disagree, however, Forest and Bird considers that the purpose of Chapter 34 is to prevent the spread of wildlands, and if left unchecked, wildlands can form dense stands which can impact on water yield, just as they can threaten the productive value of land. Potential impacts on water yield are an important reason for preventing the spread of wildlands. This is all the more critical because wildland forests can exceed commercial plantations in the area and thus have a potentially significant effect in excess of that of a plantation. No distinction should be made as to the origin of the trees. Given that district plans are required to promote sustainable management and achieve integrated management, and that one of the outcomes of preventing the spread of wildlands is the protection of the water harvesting abilities of land, it makes sense that the protection of water resources should be included in Objective 34.2, and there must be another number after that. There is only one objective, it starts 34.2.1. Apologies. Forest and Bird's preference is for radiata pine to remain prohibited, as it is an acknowledged wildlife species, and despite the proposed standards, there remain considerable risks. We note that the ability to carry out controls on any wildlife spreading to neighbouring properties is dependent upon landowner agreements, which may not always be forthcoming or may be given and then withdrawn by a new owner. We draw your attention to the recent MOU signed by Landcorp and Department of Conservation in relation to the management of potential wildlands from Douglas Fir planted by Landcorp in the vicinity of Department of Conservation Park. Failure of owners to adhere to conditions and lack of enforcement is high throughout New Zealand, as has been demonstrated by Marie Brown in their book Vanishing Nature. If plantings of radiata are provided for, council will need to ensure that they have adequate resources assigned to ensure a high level of compliance and enforcement. Council may wish to also consider the use of bonds to enable council to undertake control in the event of, for example, bankruptcy of the planting owners. Looking at the rural zone, Forest and Bird is concerned that the plan as a whole does not adequately address the issue of the preservation and protection of wetlands and their margins from inappropriate development, which is a matter of national importance. And wetlands are also a national priority to protect. Our submission sought to address this in several respects, only one of which has been recommended for adoption by the planner, and that's Objection 21.2.5 in relation to ensuring that mineral extraction does not degrade water and wetlands. We were possibly remiss in that it could be considered more relevant to address wetlands in the biodiversity chapter. However, our submission sought the addition of the term water bodies, which encode wetlands, into objective in the rural chapter 21.2.3.1. And on reflection, we should have sought the addition for objective 21.2.12 and sought the inclusion of wetlands into the corresponding policy 21.2.12.5. And our submission sought a new policy to support an amended objective to avoid the degradation of natural wetlands. So we're not certain that we can stand to be able to address that submission in a better way, because it might be better to come up with a different policy. However, we would be satisfied that our attention was added to the policy 21.2.12.5. And the standards, the one that we are most concerned about is dairy farming, milking herds, dry grazing and calf rearing. We largely support the rule, but we submitted that it needs to be extended to deer and beef cattle, and we were probably remiss in not including pigs. They might have been caught somewhere else. The government's recent consultation document, Next Steps for Freshwater 2016, proposes to introduce a national regulation that requires exclusion of dairy cattle on milking platforms from water bodies by July 2017. It is also appropriate that the rule includes dry grazing. And the Sustainable Dairy and Water Accord, which covers nearly all dairy suppliers, requires stock to be excluded from dairy farm waterways by the 1st of June 2017. And the Accord's definition of dairy farm prior to the 1st of June 2017 is limited to the milking platform and excludes any dairy and grazing land that is owned by the same person or entity as the milking platform and or farmed in association with the milking platform. However, after the 1st of June 2017, the definition of dairy farm in the Accord changes to include not only the milking platform, but also any land regularly used for grazing of dairy stock, whether or not it's contiguous with the milking platform that is owned or leased by the same entity as the milking platform. As nearly every dairy support operation owned by a dairy farmer has known for many years, they will be required by the Sustainable Dairy and Water Accord to exclude stock from waterways on their support land from 1 June 2017. This plan needs to be in step with that expectation. The planner does not recommend including deer and beef cattle, as grazing of these animals is generally less intensive. And we draw your attention to the fact that the government intends to extend the regulation to include deer on intensive farms, on plains by 2025, and on lowland rolling hills by 2030, and similarly for all beef cattle. These dates are within the time frame of the proposed QLUC plan, and it would be appropriate to include these stock classes and require their exclusion on the specified dates. Bryce and Bird is calling for both beef and deer on plains be required to comply by 2020 and on lowland rolling hills by 2025. Intensive deer farming has significant adverse effects on water quality. For example, a study in Southland on the effect of deer wallowing on water quality showed that downstream concentrations of beef coliforms were about 20 times higher than upstream of the wallowing site. And in another study, Isles found that streams drained in deer farms showed high average levels of thermotolerant Campylobacter, second only to dairy catchments. Cattle also cause significant damage to riparian habitats along the edges of streams, wetlands and lakes, which can radically alter ecology, stream ecology. So, in conclusion, Forest and Bird commends the Council for the substantial progress made in the identification and protection of SNAs, recognition of the importance of maintaining Indigenous biodiversity and wildlife trees, and getting stock out of walkways as the next step forward. Major step forward. Thank you.
Thank you, Kelly. Do you have any
questions? I do have a question. We've had, as I know you're aware, we've had evidence from the Department of Conservation on irrigation being included in the definition of Indigenous vegetation clearance. And we've also had evidence from landowners highlighting the difficulty of, firstly, I think, kind of understanding when they might need to identify that Indigenous vegetation and the way that they might assess the likely effect of irrigation on it. So just in light of the policy 33.2.2.1 that you highlighted, which is, I hope there's just, it would be...
Sorry, Sorry,
33.2.2.1. It's in regard to vegetation clearance in SNAs. In light of the strengthening of that policy, how important do you think the definition of irrigation as a Indigenous vegetation clearance technique is if we're strengthening up the protection of SNAs and areas that would meet the criteria to be an SNA?
But if clearance wasn't, if irrigation wasn't a clearance, then irrigation would be exempt. Would it be considered as a development proposal that would result in clearance of Indigenous vegetation?
it wouldn't be included in the definition of
so it wouldn't,
Indigenous vegetation clearance.
Don't quite see how that would help us.
So what I'm, so the question is, if we're strengthening up our policies around SNAs and the protection of Indigenous vegetation within them, if we think about SNAs as being the primary tool that we might use to protect Indigenous flora, is it just as important to manage, for example, the irrigation on actively farmed land?
I think the thing is that
grappling with.
In both Queenstown Lakes and Central Otago, where most of your remaining Indigenous vegetation that has high threat values is in these highly threatened lowland areas that are being irrigated. And most of those ones are dryland plants, so they're adapted to drylands. They're not adapted to having water on them, so they're not going to survive under a watering system. So in our view, it is a form of clearance. And because not all the SNAs are identified, we still need to be able to identify them. Essentially, any time somebody is irrigating a lowland paddock that is modified vegetation, because most of it is now modified, but you'll find that pretty much all of those areas are likely to be have some areas of significant indigenous vegetation. Just because there's so few of them left, and most of those areas are fine through the species.
Okay, so you're saying that any additional irrigation on those lowland paddocks is likely to...
If there's not irrigation there now...
Yes.
Because if there is irrigation, most of them will have gone.
And it's changed already.
It's changed already, but new irrigation...
Yes.
It is a form of clearance, because the plants just become smothered and they become faster. They've been cleared, they've gone.
Okay.
I'm not sure if I've answered your question.
Yeah, my question's around the importance. I understand that it's your view that the irrigation is a form of clearance. The question is if we're strengthening our policies around protection of SNAs, do we need to be just as strong outside of them? And
yes.
I think your answer is yes, you think
yes.
We do.
Because you're not likely to have identified all the SNAs.
Yes.
And in our view, areas that have potential SNA value should be treated in a similar manner to those that have been identified.
Thank you.
Shouldn't be a distinction just because they haven't been identified. It's not the plant's fault that they haven't been identified.
Question number, any questions?
No, thank you.
Specifically, that's very clear. Thank you.
No, I have no questions.
Thank you.
Thank you. I mean, we're happy to, because I know that the rules are, labels are tricky, and we're very happy to help out or sit in a room and brainstorm how to fix them with Federated Farmers. But we think you're pretty...
Now, pass on that question, folks, and first of all, if you want to get away, you can.
I won't.
You don't need to listen to this question.
Yeah.
What we'd like addressed in the write-up reply is, in light of the evidence that we've heard from the Department of Conservation and landowners, if SNAs are the key method for Indigenous vegetation protection, do we need to control irrigation as a vegetation clearance method? That's a fairly broad question for Mr. Davis to address on.
received and understood.
Thanks, I'll pass it on. But you're going to also give me a bit of paper too, that's why I'm not writing it down. I'm taking it in as well. Thank you. I'll pass that on to her.
And I will adjourn the hearing from 9 a.m.